whoever and wherever you are at this moment, we want you to know that you are welcome here, regardless of your age or abilities, the color of your skin, where you were born, regardless of whom you love or how you identify your gender, if you do. Whatever your spiritual practices may be, if you have none, we are glad that you are here with us this morning. I want to especially welcome newcomers and visitors, whether they are... This past week was the General Assembly, the yearly gathering together of Unitarian Universalists from all around the country. And I hope that many of you attended some of the sessions they had, and especially last Sunday's service, which was online. And now, as we light the chalice, the symbol of our shared and scattered faith, let us consider these words from Pat Uren. We gather, we bring our sorrows, our disappointments, our failures. We gather for healing and laughter and to rejoice. We gather to find new ways of loving, new ways of thinking, new ways of being. We gather, yes, we always gather, for it is in gathering that we find our hope. Let us speak together our opening affirmation. Open our eyes to see what is beautiful. Let us open our minds to learn what is true. Let us open our hearts to love one another. And Natalie Reich will do a reading.
The wind whistles in the bamboo, and the bamboo dances. When the wind stops, the bamboo grows still. A silver bird flies over the autumn lake. When it has passed, the lake surface does not try to hold on to the image of the bird. This is a poem about grasping and clinging, not grasping and clinging, that Thich Nhat Hanh quotes in one of his books.
Now, Andrian has a reading.
This is from Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse. It is a good thing to experience everything oneself, he thought. As a child, I learned that pleasures of the world and riches were not good. I have known it for a long time, but I have only just experienced it. Now I know it, not only with my intellect, but with my eyes, with my heart, and with my stomach. It is a good thing I know this. He thought long of the change in him, listening to the birds singing happily. If this bird within him had died, would he have perished? No, something else in him had died, something that he had long desired should perish. Was it not what he had once wished to destroy during his ardent years of asceticism? Was it not his self, his small, proud, fearful self, with which he had wrestled for so many years, but which had always conquered him again, which appeared each time again and again, which robbed him of happiness and filled him with fear? Was it not this which had died today in the wood by this delightful river? Was it not because of its death that he was now like a child, so full of trust and happiness, without fear?
And now it is time for two of our members, who have just done their readings, to talk with us about how Buddhism has changed my life.
I'm Natalie, and thank you for being here. That poem about non-clinging or grasping is one of the many pearls that influence my life when I do invite them in. The original proposed title of this talk was Why I Am a Buddhist, but I'm uncomfortable claiming to be one, since I don't have a pure, steady, committed practice. And I've never followed a teacher for very long. Having been raised in a secular Jewish family, I used to envy people with a religious affiliation and belief system. I sensed their confidence and belonging, and sometimes even a shinier light in their eyes. But religious faith wasn't part of my DNA, and I had trouble fitting into most of the communities that I knew of. One thing that helped me grapple with that lostness was my desultory search into Buddhist and related Eastern thought and practices. It all started while I was in college through a Kundalini yoga class in Topanga Canyon. That awoke me to a sense of oneness via breath and chanting. Shortly thereafter, I began reading Chogyam Trungpa's books. I did the usual 60s and 70s dabble, practicing TM for a while, reading Ram Dass, Krishnamurti, Alan Watts, Then I attended one of Chogyam Trungpa's talks, thinking I might join a sangha that followed him. But I was turned off by his arrogance and rudeness. He seemed to be mean-spirited in his responses to earnest questions, and it was the opposite of what drew me into his books. Alan Watts, though, enabled me to not throw out the baby with the bathwater. A quote from one of his books called The Taboo Against Knowing Who You Really Are. Irrevocable commitment to any religion is only intellectual suicide. It is positive unfaith because it closes the mind to any new vision of the world. Faith is above all openness, an act of trust in the unknown. Buddhism, on the other hand, didn't seem preachy. It seemed based on trusting one's own experience more than it did on beliefs. Reading Watts and Krishnamurti, though, didn't provide a sense of community or connection. And the spiritual path was replaced for a while by psychology as I entered grad school, really more to find myself than as a career path, at least initially. Years later, my interest in Buddhism was rekindled by its application to my counseling practice, as well as my own general well-being. In fact, later into my career, a trend in psychology was called dialectical behavioral therapy, which blends cognitive behavioral and Buddhist practice. DBT teaches skills that are taken directly from one of Thich Nhat Hanh's books, and they're taught and practiced with concrete applications to life's dilemmas. They're grouped into mindfulness skills, emotion regulation, distress tolerance, and interpersonal skills. An intensive DBT program has provided a path out of painful lives for many depressed, anxious, and even traumatized individuals, as well as those that just simply have a lousy attitude. Walking the Buddhist Noble Eightfold Path is very similar in its intent and its practice. Facilitating DBT groups with women in recovery from addiction was very rewarding. One example, instead of the 70s fad of assertiveness training that was all about getting what you want, remember the broken record technique? This schema of interpersonal skills featured a process for evaluating how strongly to ask or say what you want, or say yes, based on the bigger picture of each relationship. And right relationship is one of the tenets of the Noble Eightfold Path of Buddhism, along with, I'll just name them all, right view, right thinking, right mindfulness, right speech, right action, right diligence, right concentration, and right livelihood. It's a path that provides a prescription for leading an ethical and satisfying life, as do the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism, as do the four modules of dialectical behavioral therapy. I found the Unitarians shortly before moving from Seattle to Portland, and it was a good fit. Later on, I called it a more extroverted form of Buddhism. It was the community that drew me there, and here as well, and also the seven principles. And later, Woof birthed the beginnings of our current Buddhist Sangha. Buddhism reminds me that everything changes. Therefore, grasping only adds suffering to the pain of loss, as stated in the opening poem, and it adds more suffering to existential pain. This is one of the more persistent ways that it has influenced my life. I joined an earlier version of this Sangha at WUF 20-some years ago, and it influenced me to develop some sort of a meditation practice. I was in and out of the Sangha for a few years until I began attending more regularly the last few years. And the main thing that has drawn me is that it keeps reminding me to be present, compassionate, and accepting. And I do need a lot of reminding. It's very helpful to hear my Sangha mates share their take on what we read and the similar yet varied struggles that we all have in our effort to remain truly awake. It reminds me to do something most days that I would call my practice. The minimum of that practice is this: spending a few moments, at least once, and usually several times a day, just noticing my emotions, thoughts, and sensations non-judgmentally. And most days I add to this a sitting or standing meditation of 10 minutes or so, sometimes more, or some Qigong exercises, or simply tuning into stillness, tuning out of my thought stream one way or another for a few minutes. I believe that these activities all help me stay awake, both literally and physically. Figuratively, not physically. The benefit of my practice, such as it is, includes more emotional equilibrium, noticing my harsh judgments sooner, better ability to reframe the harsh judgments and not judging my judgment so much, more awareness of my physical and emotional state, which engenders a better control of my actions and less acting out of quote-unquote emotion mind, a DBT term. Of course, Buddhism is not... I lost my place here. That happened. Sorry. Is not free of beliefs. The most well-known is reincarnation, and I believe in some version of this, but wouldn't call it a major influence in my life. I suspect that when we die, our matter slash energy merges with the cosmos. Recently, I turned toward a book I found at a friend's house called Approaching the Buddhist Path by the Dalai Lama, along with her teacher, Thubten Chodron. And it explains reincarnation in terms of mind energy, which is separate from our physical brain, and that it goes specifically from our being to that of another. Thus, we are reincarnated into another individual life, as shown in the movies about the birth of the Dalai Lama. And I have more chewing to do on that thought. But it certainly does appear that our current Dalai Lama was no accident. Our Sangha recently read a book by Eckhart Tolle in which he echoes something that I read a long time ago in The Tao of Physics by Fritjof Capra. I don't have a direct quote, but he alludes to the fact that the material world is composed of the same energy as that which pervades the non-material world, but denser. Buddhism and science are therefore compatible. We all share universal energy, or qi. I once asked an acquaintance who also was inclined toward Buddhism, in one word, how would he capture the essence of Buddhism? And he said, emptiness. My word at that time would have been connection. And I thought we were on opposite ends of a pole. I still can't claim to completely understand the concept of emptiness, the Buddhist concept of it, as thoroughly as I could, but I know that it has something to do with uncluttering the mind of thought so that our experience is pure, so that we're awake to the reality of the present moment. And without that, there could be no true connection. This is a simplistic version, but I do now see that emptiness and connection are two sides of the same coin. I'm going to conclude with a question from the Book of Questions that I once pulled from a shelf to stimulate conversation among my extended family. If you could choose to never wake up from a delightful sleep in which you had only the most fabulous dreams of peaceful, beautiful worlds that fulfilled your every wish, would you choose to stay eternally asleep? And one of my cousins couldn't see any reason to wake up from such a dream. And I can't imagine actively choosing not to be awake. Perhaps that's the greatest influence of Buddhism on me. And I invite you now to, for another little brief meditation before we invite Anna, to just let your body settle as comfortably as possible and notice your breath for a few moments. And just notice where your attention lands without trying to control it. Leave your mind alone. Notice sensations, notice breathing, notice whatever comes into your awareness with all of its nuances and without attempting to alter anything. Just leave your mind alone.
So welcome back. My understanding was the title of this was how Buddhist ideas have inspired my life. I think ideas that have come to me, which I will talk about in a minute, have been like polar stars. You know, I resonate with them and they point to true north. Some ideas come to me almost like can openers, that life situations present themselves and I can use them like a can opener to create a change out of my normal reactive brain to give me that pregnant pause where I am aware of irritation or fear without having it grab me. And so Buddhist ideas have really been there for me. You know, they keep being there for me. The Buddhist group that I now attend here continues with the books we've been reading to inspire new ones. I was lucky in the 1952 presidential election. My parents, Madge and Alan Palmer, were so enamored of Adlai Stevenson that they made a Gigunda change, which influenced my life profoundly. They changed from being Republican Methodists to being Democratic Unitarians. We lived in Hyde Park, and I was privileged to be part of the Poughkeepsie lay-led at that time, just beginning fellowship, where I knew other adults as well as I knew myself. I knew other families. I knew how they worked. I had an incredible lifelong friendship developed with a woman who chose me at the age of 5 as being her special friend, Claire Gutman. And I was accompanied. I had a community. I sensed I was not alone because I was a part of this community. In fact, one time there was an adult service, and I came upstairs, and everybody was agitated. Everybody was very agitated. So I stopped this woman who was carrying empty cups. I said, "Are they okay?" She looks around. She goes, "It was a good service. They'll be back next week." But it was so fun because here's this adult answering my question. My mother was my Sunday school teacher in second grade. We studied different myths of creation. And I remember stopping her in the middle of the hubbub to say, "Okay, Mom, which one of these is true? They're different. And I'm a second grader. I know there's only one right answer and everything else is wrong." So my mom really heard my question and went inside herself. And a few minutes later, the light bulb comes on and she comes out and she leans in real close and she smiles. "People are different. That's why these stories reflect those differences. All of these stories are true." That blew my mind. It still blows my mind. And then when I finished the White Plains Unitarian Sunday School and they were going to tell us what Unitarians believed, I thought, they gave us a historical background and then the two people sat there and smiled. And I said, "Well, when are you going to tell us what we believe?" And they looked at me and they looked at each other, they looked at me and then they laughed and they said, "You'll figure it out." So existential angst was mine during my adolescence. I had the responsibility of finding the truth, and I really felt it. I felt it profoundly. It's almost like we wanted to get up and get up to truth speed, and I would fall back down. So when somehow, and I don't remember how it came in, that Buddhist said, ending suffering, to choose the middle path. That came to me somehow. And in the roller coaster of hormones in life, the concept of a middle path really centered me. You know, just that suffering could end. If I can get centered and peaceful, I can stop suffering. And I think Sid Arthur came after by Hermann Hesse, and I think the story of his enlightenment is so exciting because he's just a human being, like me or you. I mean, he had the same kind of looking for truth. He wanted truth. He was willing to turn over all the stones to look for it. So I could relate to him as a man looking for the truth as I was looking. I also think that at WUF, when I used to attend here, there was one time when Juanita Wade, who was one of the choristers sitting up here, and there was a pause, and she said, "Last night it rained really hard. When I went out this morning, I could hear my fir trees drink." And there was this moment. Like with the water, I mean, the river. Unitarians frequently go out in nature when they want to be connected. You know, I think that has been an ongoing. And so I think that the image of the river connecting him to a level of joy and laughter and the present moment, which is always tumbling into the next present moment. I mean, it's always changing. The Siddhartha really helped me feel less lost or feel like from the Christian story where, you know, they crucified Jesus at the end. I mean, this is a much happier ending, that he becomes childlike and no fear. And he's not separated into different parts. He's in the moment. The Buddhist group I started attending here before COVID in the Acorn Room, and Joanne Nordling, who is one of the founders, would sometimes be the leader of the group. And Joanne had a twinkle in her that was just incredible. Whether she was leaving or not, she'd twinkle at me when I would come in, especially if I was late. I just always felt so included. And I didn't like reading the books, although I liked coming, and people who were leaders frequently did their homework, and they had nice handouts about the pages in the book, and they would give this to me, and then we would talk about the ideas. I could jump in with the ideas. I didn't have to read the book at that time. So that was lovely. And then when Woof started, Norma Heiser and Wanda Corey, who are friends of mine, let me know that they had started meeting in the Grove. Well, having been a member here for 20 years, sitting in the Grove was like time traveling. You know, everyone I've ever known, all the experiences I've ever had are right there in that Grove. Ugh. It is a marvelous place to meditate. And then for a while we're in the rain under the coffee table, and then we finally got to come inside where there's heat in a bathroom. I like the fact that you don't have to read the book. You don't have to be on the same page, although it's nice when people do, as I said, as leaders, provide a cheat sheet and also a sort of jumping off part. But the power of now, which Natalie, he referred to, the Eckhart Tolle, one of the can openers that he gave me was, life presents situations. I get to make them into problems or not. I mean, I think mindfulness has helped me have that pregnant awareness when something irritating is rising. Instead of it hooking me and me reacting, I can see it coming up and be mindful of getting the message of it, but without feeding it fear or anger. I mean, I get how mindfulness practice is giving me this wonderful pregnant pause before my ego charges in to save the day, either with rage or fear. That peaceful moment, the ability to not get my ego triggered, not to have to defend myself. And I think the can opener of being able to have directions. Like I was walking to the bus the other day, and I recognized how I love to scare myself. And I said, why am I scaring myself all the time? Because I'm worried about not being on time. It's like, and I go, wait, stop. And I calmed down, and I felt like the present moment caught up with me. It was almost like I calmed myself down, and I was in the present moment. So a lot of my meditation that I practice every day is, am I breathing? Because I have a tendency to hold my breath. Am I in this moment? You know, because I think the ego is all about the past and trying to project what's going to happen to the future as if you have some kind of control, rather than just being in the moment and being present. The Tao of physics, which Natalie also referred to, was Tao of physics was a book that I read, and it explains Eastern mysticism and then quantum physics, and then it explains how they say the same thing. And when he said that truth can't be a product, it has to be an open system, I started to cry, because that's what Unitarianism is, or Buddhism is, or any path. I mean, you don't get it and hold on to it like, I got it. No, it's an open process. It's like the river. It's a joyful moment to moment, staying present, remembering to breathe, remember to stay in my body, because I have a tendency to start flapping out the door. But I think the Buddhism for me has been an end of suffering. It has clued into mindfulness practices that are really changing how I work. I used to be a monkey mind person, and I used to have wars of parts of my personality. It was very noisy in my head as a teenager. So that central path, where I personally think that when we get scared, that's the reptile brain. But if we can pause long enough and realize we're not in danger, we crawl up to our cerebral cortex, which takes a long time to turn on, and we turn it on. And from there, we get a really spacious view. And most times, there's nothing really totally right or totally wrong. It's just part of the total spectrum that's possible. So we're all spirits and matter having a human experience. But if we can get out of the fear and rage, adrenaline, noradrenaline, triggers, which I think the lower brain stem is all about, and come up to that pristine mindfulness, which is a book we're reading right now. you know, turning it on and watching the clouds of irritation or attraction or rejection come and go without having them trigger me to take me around and down into the mud, which is why I used to like to go. By the way, I was a great Eeyore. I was very, very easily triggered, and I would go down to the mud, and I would make sure not only I was miserable, but everyone around me was miserable. So it's much nicer to be a more Buddha-brained person who really is into being just in the moment, and it's a joy to be in the moment and not having to rush on to the next one. So we would like to open for discussion if people would like to discuss what we just talked about or ask questions. Do you want to come back up again? Is it possible that we have a mic that we could go around with? Is that?
Give us a second.
Is that okay, good.
Hi. For the congregation, could you discuss when the Sangha meets and what your current book is? Who is welcome and what time and place you're currently meeting?
We're currently meeting in Forest Hall from 9:30 to 10:30.
No,
oh, 9 to 10. Sorry, don't come at 9:30. You'll be late. 9 to 10. It's also available on Zoom when the Zoom is working. We're just finishing The Pristine Mind, I believe. Do you know what the next book is going to be?
We haven't chosen the next book yet. I know one has been suggested, and I can't remember the title of it. It's Tony somebody. And I'm pretty sure that'll be the next book. But we're going to have a potluck. Probably towards the end of August or September, and then we'll go through the books that rejected the last time and other suggestions that people make and pick another book.
And it's by volunteer, the leader changes, and anyone can come. I mean, we're open to people coming and joining with us. So
at your meetings, do you read and discuss? Do you take time for meditation? How do you structure them?
Right now the structure is that we do a brief check-in around the circle, just what's been going on, sometimes in relation to the reading, sometimes just whatever. Then we discuss the reading. There's a facilitator that kind of reminds us which pages we're on if people choose to read the book. Lately that's been getting a little bit looser. And that goes on for about 20 minutes or until the meditation period, which is 20 minutes, the very last period. But we talked today actually about trying the meditation first, because it kind of puts the energy in a clearer frame, and it might make for a better discussion. So, not that we don't have good discussions, but...
Well, actually, we suggested that we would check in, and check in first and then meditate and maybe do the book at the end, because a new person suggested we might be in a more mindful place to discuss the thing after meditating. But I also wanted to say that the check-in is crucially important to me because it's a small community, and I get to talk about me and get support for the things that are going on in my life, and then I get to hear about other people's lives, some of the people that I've known, for like Natalie, for a long time, but some people that are new. And that sense of community, that even though it's small and it's varied because people come and go or the people on Zoom zoom in and when it's working, but it's part of being a member of a community, which is an extraordinarily important spiritual component of mine. And during the COVID, I am very poignantly aware of how isolating and isolated I became. And so this sense of check-in for me, some people don't like it, but I absolutely adore it.
Hi, I'm Spencer Ehrman. What is a can opener?
What is a can opener? Okay. To me, ideas that when they resonate and they change me forever, when I get triggered, instead of going into a rage or fear, I can bring out an idea and change what's happening for myself. It's like opening it up to higher energies, more possibilities. Because again, I think that the primal brain, like my story to my mother, which of these stories is true, we want to feel safe, and we feel safe immediately. And sometimes, you know, that shutting down and revving up, that, if you have to do that. But it's much nicer if you can come up and smile and use the can opener idea of, I don't have to stay in fear right now. I don't have to... this moment doesn't have to freeze me. I have been struggling as a post-traumatic stress syndrome person for many years, and it's recently I've just come into a new layer of the onion, so to speak, of recognizing how much I've been frozen in fear. So for me, a can opener is something that helps me pry my way out of staying frozen in fear or believing my rage that I'm busy projecting out on the world and then, you know, doing whatever that tells me to do. So it's an idea that really changes how I behave, you know, and I can use it because it's my can opener.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience of New Buddhism. I started a path when I was in my 40s. You know, I was full-time mom, full-time worker, and a full-time wife. And I just thought my world was just so complicated. I couldn't make sense of it. And I found Thich Nhat Hanh, Living Buddha, Living Christ. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, you don't have to believe that there is one source. Wherever you are is okay. And that was such a relief, you know. I'm okay being torn in so many different directions, and, you know, it will come. And I want to share that a joy. My daughter has just started orthodontic school, and 16 years ago, I went up there to share that she had just gone off to college, and I cried. But when Natalie said, not grasping, letting go. So Buddhism has changed me in 16 years. I've learned to let go. So,
anyone else? Okay, thank you. You want any closing words?
Do some closing words? Do you have anything to add?
Oh, not really. Just that it's been joyous to share this with you. And you're all welcome to come and try us out, 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings.
And thank you so much to Woof for having this lovely space, the Grove today here, and also Forest Hall, because, you know, having a spiritual home that's morphed over the years many times for me, this is where I feel like I spiritually have a deep taproot, and it's very delightful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne and Natalie. That was very inspiring.
Thank you.
This is the time in our service when we pause to reflect on the gifts that we have received from this abundant earth and the generous spirit of family and community, to consider what it is that we have given and what it is that we are grateful for. During the musical interlude, please consider the gifts that you have to offer our Woof community, whether it is financial support, or the special gift of your time or talent, know that we are grateful for your offering. And let us remember, it is love that built our community, love that built the fires that warm us and planted the trees that shade us. We drink from wells we did not dig, and we are ever grateful for all of the early stewards of this land, beginning with the original peoples, the indigenous tribes, many of whom live among us today, and to whom our doors are always open. Woof exists because of the generous spirit and commitment of all those who have come before us, just as the future health depends on the dedication and commitment of those here now. For those who are present, you may put your contributions in the basket as you leave. Join me, please, in our affirmation of gratitude and giving. Let us be grateful when we are able to give, for many do not have that privilege. Let us be grateful, even those who share their gifts with us, for we are enriched by their giving. And let us be grateful, even for our needs, so that we may learn from the generosity of others. And now, as I extinguish the chalice, let us carry within us the warm glow of its flame and the values of Unitarian Universalism.
Carry on.